You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with author and professor Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck University. Oscar, good morning. What have you got in store for us today?
We've got anti-terrorist arrests in London, indigenous protests in the wake of Columbus Day in the Americas, plus the world taken hostage by the US crisis.
Also, it is a big week for Angela Merkel as she enters into new rounds of talks to pick a coalition partner. But who is it going to be? We are on the ground in Berlin to consider her options.
Plus,
let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be.
Our man in Belgrade has been singing Beatles songs with the Serbian Prime Minister. No, really. We'll find out if they've been having any effect whatsoever on his politics.
And we join our culture editor in Doha, where he's been talking to British artist Damien Hirst about the art he is striving to create.
I make work that, you know, I'd like people to get passionate about. And I'm very aware that they can be passionately against it as well as passionately for it. So I want to make work that you kind of can't forget.
All that, plus a run-through of the Spanish front pages, and we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
A court in Malaysia has ruled non-Muslims cannot use the word Allah to refer to God. It's overturned a ruling by a lower court 4 years ago that it's saying it would cause confusion in the community. Christians say they've used the word in Malay for many years and argue the ruling is a violation of their religious rights. It's come at a time of heightened ethnic and religious tensions in Malaysia. A Catholic newspaper, The Herald, is at the centre of the case. Its editor, Lawrence Andrew, is worried about the impact on Malaysia's minority Christian community.
The nation must support and protect the rights of the minorities. So we should not be discouraged because in this land we still have the law and we still can hope for our rights to be exercised.
Officials in eastern India say a mass evacuation saved thousands of lives as a fierce cyclone struck the area. Up to 1 million people fled their homes as the cyclone ruined homes, brought down power lines and destroyed trees. So far, it's thought 18 people died in the states of Andhra Pradesh and Orissa. Meanwhile, it's now thought at least 109 people died in a stampede at a Hindu festival in central India. Many were on a bridge close to a temple near the town of Datia. It's thought the stampede was caused by rumours that the bridge was about to collapse. The head of the International Monetary Fund has warned the budget crisis in the United States could tip the world into recession. Christine Lagarde says a US default would cause massive disruption the world over. The government will start to run out of money on Thursday if there's no agreement to raise its debt limit. But in a rare Sunday session of the US Senate, Democrat leader Harry Reid raised the prospect of a deal.
I've had a productive conversation with Republican leader. Our discussions were substantive and we'll continue those discussions. I'm optimistic about the prospects for a positive conclusion to the issues before this country today.
Ahead of international talks on Iran's nuclear program, the country is warning it will not hand over any of its enriched uranium. Representatives from Iran are to meet international negotiators in Geneva this week, but Iran's foreign minister says any request to surrender stockpiles of enriched uranium would cross a red line. The UK is to make it easier for Chinese visitors to enter the country. The visa system is to be simplified, meaning Chinese tourists for the rest of the European Union will no longer need a separate visa to enter the UK. The deal was announced by the Finance Minister, George Osborne, who's currently in China.
We are two great trading nations with a shared interest in keeping the trade routes of the world open and free. And yes, of course, we have differences, different political systems, we attach value to different things, and we shouldn't be afraid of pointing out where we disagree. But let us not do it in a way that is not respectful of each other.
Argentina's president has left hospital 5 days after surgery to remove a blood clot on her brain. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has been told to rest for 30 days. Officials say she's in high spirits, but it's not clear when she'll resume her duties. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Paul Osborne. It's 5 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House live from Studio One in London. It is time now to set the day's news agenda. Joining us today in the studio is author and professor Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck University here in London. Welcome to the programme, Oscar. Your first story is something we actually just heard on the news as well. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, has warned that a US default could tip the world into recession. And in a similar fashion, the president of the World Bank has been warning about this very same thing.
This is history repeating. We've been here before, we'll be here again. The president of the World Bank has urged US policymakers to reach a deal to raise the government's debt ceiling by Thursday at the very latest. Otherwise, he's warning of dire consequences to the world economy.
Oscar, there is a sense amongst the Republicans, or there's been this line that's come out recently that actually, particularly from Rand Paul, the Kentucky senator, that the government doesn't have to default even if the ceiling is not raised. He told CNN that not raising the debt ceiling means you have to balance your budget. It doesn't mean you have to default. But clearly, the US is not in a position to not default on Thursday if talks really continue to be in total stalemate, as it looks like they are.
Well, it shows how out of touch with reality many of the U.S. politicians blocking these are. I mean, of course, it is impossible for the United States not to default by Thursday. You cannot balance your budget in 4 or 5 days.
And in terms of the global impact of that, as we've heard Christine Lagarde say, it's been discussed for the last 2 weeks. But the sense of just kicking the can down the road and really no progress being made whatsoever, what does that really mean for the global economy? We've never seen a default on this scale before.
No, we have never seen that. And that means nobody really knows what will happen. What is known is that given the fact that the US dollar is the base currency for many developing world countries, the effect would be felt there first. But it will also, so it will affect exports. And then, of course, it will create a sort of chain reaction around the globe.
And what we are seeing taking place in the US now is a massive argument over ideology and it's about principle at the same time. And we're talking about very big things over here. We're getting these warnings from all these people, Christine Lagarde and the president of the World Bank. Do you think this is actually going to make a difference? Do you think these comments are going to make any change when it comes to the discussion taking place in the US?
Probably not. What seems to be making a difference is the fact that polls in the United States are making it very clear that the U.S. public is reacting against Republicans. Only 24% of the U.S. population feels that the Republicans' actions are conducive to anything good in the country. So the Republicans have never faced this level of unpopularity. In fact, it seems the case that the whole, taking the U.S. and the world to ransom is blowing back in the faces.
With the talks having seemed to collapse, all attention now is on two consummate congressional dealmakers, the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and his Republican counterpart, Senator Mitch McConnell. How significant are these two men, and how likely is it that their negotiations will lead to any sort of a breakthrough?
They both represent the moderate wings of the respective parties, which is how the constitutional system of the United States is supposed to work. You know, the constitutional system of the U.S. is designed to block majorities, overwhelming minorities. But in these cases, you know, that safeguard is having terrible results. So it is up to the moderate wings of both parties to come together. The question remains whether the moderate wing of the Republican Party will be able to control its more extremist members.
Well, moving on to your second story for this day is from the weekend. Scotland Yard's Anti-Terrorism Command deployed elite armed officers in London to arrest four suspected terrorists. What do you think? What is the significance of this story?
You know, there are two things that interest me about this story. The first one is its vagueness. You know, try as much as you can, and all we know is that arrests took place at three sites across East, West and South London. The counter-terrorism chiefs have said in a very abstract way that the main threats to the United Kingdom come from Al-Qaeda-inspired groups. Not Al-Qaeda anymore, but Al-Qaeda-inspired groups, whatever they are. And also dissident Irish Republicans. A witness mentioned that a white man had been arrested, and that's all we know. Of course, we know that a certain secrecy is required for these sorts of actions. And yet, one wonders if it produces, you know, it becomes a form of fear-mongering.
And what I'm actually wondering now as well when you say that is that if they don't want to reveal any information whatsoever, if all we know that they have arrested one white man, why did they actually announce that they had still arrested four suspected terrorists?
That's becoming a serious problem. I mean, of course, this arrest comes in the wake of, you know, serious questions being asked in this country about the oversight of intelligence services, you know, in the wake of the Snowden revelations and so on. So it is, you know, it is quite well timed, if you like, to prove that, yes, this secrecy and this information is required if we are to maintain security. And yet, what seems to come through is this tremendous vagueness. We don't know what they are arrested. We don't know who they are. I mean, a threat as varied and different as Irish republicanism or Al-Qaeda, well, all the common citizen can think of is, yes, you know, there's a vague enemy out there out to get us.
But do you think there is a sense that it's a bit of a wake-up call just to be reminded that these sorts of terror investigations are still taking place? Because, you know, touch wood, God forbid, it's been a while since London saw a major terrorist attack. And in many ways, Londoners, like New Yorkers, like Madrileños, we're very resilient people. You get up, you just go on about it. There's a certain degree of complacency that can come in. Do you think it's important, in a sense, to be reminded that these kind of activities are going on in the capital, even if we don't yet know the specifics?
I mean, no doubt. Of course, terrorism exists. Of course, it is out there. The problem seems to be this, you know, tremendous need for maintaining a shroud of secrecy, and that seems it seems that it's not working as much in terms of public trust as it used to do before.
And moving on to Americas now, it's Columbus Day.
It's Columbus Day, but not as we know it. You know, wild celebrations take place in some places. For indigenous peoples in the Americas, little has changed. Many protests, particularly in Chile, in Mexico, also in Brazil, but also persecution and killings continuing.
Oscar, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, author and professor, of course, at Birkbeck University.
Coming up, we are in the German capital to assess Chancellor Merkel's chances of building the coalition she seeks this week.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guides to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, our editors take to the roads to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors, and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping, and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're heading in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Shops. Who needs them? Well, we all do if you want a vibrant neighbourhood, a sense of community, healthy food and outlets for small producers. In the October issue of Monocle, we check out the future of retail around the world and meet the people who believe in bricks and mortar shops. It's an inspiring round of global window shopping.
We're going electronic in the D section. First, we go to Zurich to meet the people who are helping jumpstart the image of electric bikes with the aid of improved design. And we'll also be deconstructing the look of BMW's first foray into e-cars. And then we'll turn off the switches altogether and go eco in Maui, paying a visit to a beautifully natural home built atop a cliff overlooking the Pacific.
In the edit section, we drive through the Tuscan Hills until we reach the Antinori Winery and take a private tour with a family that's been running the label since the 4th century. We also interview singer Alison Goldfrapp over a fish and chips meal in London. And if you're still hungry for more, check out our recipe for the perfect lobster roll, all the way from Maine, America's seafood capital.
And there's a lot more to ponder, digest and enjoy too. The October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Chancellor Angela Merkel faces a stiffening challenge to form a government this week. Her CDU-CSU bloc were just 5 seats short of an absolute majority, making it the biggest election victory since German reunification.
But the difficulty for Angela Merkel of navigating coalition talks belies the extent of the win. She's held exploratory talks with Germany's Green Party and will be entering into a second round of talks with her main rival, the Social Democrats, today. So who will she choose, or rather, should that be, convince to go into government with? Well, joining us now to discuss this further is Andreas Kluth, Berlin Bureau Chief for The Economist. Andreas, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, good morning.
What sort of options are on the table for Merkel today, and especially as she goes into this second round of negotiations with the SDU?
Well, her options are still officially the same that they've been since the election on September 22nd, which is basically there's only what her old coalition partner was ejected from the parliament, so she can only choose from the two center-left parties. There's the only other party is the far-left party. That's the only other party in parliament. And the two center-left parties, you just mentioned them in your prologue. It's the Social Democrats, the SPD, or the Greens. The Greens, she has held one round of exploratory talks with each of them in large groups. I should add there's an important complicating factor. She's actually not, it's not Angela Merkel and her party negotiating with either the SPD or the Greens. It's actually Angela Merkel and her party and the Bavarian offshoot of her center-right camp, which is its own party. So actually, there's always 3 parties in these rooms at the moment, and they're each bringing about 7 people to the table. So that's a lot of people. And the Greens are in a peculiar position because they had a very, very bad election result, and they're in the process of swapping their entire party leadership and trying to figure out where they want to go, and that makes them somewhat unstable in these talks. Social Democrats have an entirely different problem, which is a lot of the party members do not want this grand coalition. That's what it's called when the SPD and the CDU form a partnership. And the party leader of the Social Democrats, Sigmar Gabriel is his name, for tactical reasons, he probably had no other choice, but said that if we enter coalition talks, you know, formal talks, which probably will happen by the end of the week, then at the end of that, the party members get to vote whether they accept that. And that introduced an element of uncertainty into this whole process that's actually in this form never been there in post-war German politics.
And as Clemency mentioned earlier, the situation for Angela Merkel seems to be that she needs to practically convince someone to go into government with her. Why does it all seem to be so particularly hard for her this time?
It's from viewed from the outside, it's probably perplexing, especially because, I mean, the ultimate irony is that there are no big issues separating these people when you view it from outside Germany. They, during the campaign, they all made, the big issues were really off the table because they were very close on those. And I mean the euro crisis and perhaps even the transition to more renewable energies. All the small issues, though, viewed from the outside small, have sort of taken on a sort of religious fervor almost, and no one can seem to be backing down now from what they said just a few weeks ago in the campaign. So the main one is tax, you know, do we hike taxes, introduce new taxes or not? Angela Merkel's two parties said no. Both the left, all three left parties said yes. So that's the main sticking point. They'll have to, someone will have to climb down publicly over that. That's difficult. And then over family policies, certain subsidies for childcare, and all things that, you know, viewed from outside Germany would seem really trivial given what's going on right now in the world economy and in the world and in foreign policy. But it just, they've all rhetorically boxed themselves into these tight corners in recent months and weeks, that it's just hard to get out of them right now.
Andreas, you mentioned that this kind of instability has never been seen in post-war Germany before. And, I mean, recently there was even talks about whether there would be a new election and what this would really mean. Is there a real hunger amongst the German populace to just get this sorted and quickly?
Very much so. The German population has, throughout, even before the election and now, large majorities want a grand coalition. Even large majorities of SPD voters, as opposed to members. So the German people, they've moved on to other scandals, religious scandals at the moment, and so forth. They want a government. They want to move on. They weren't really in a particularly revolutionary mode at any point of this year, anyway. But that's not sort of driving this. And you mentioned, by the way, that recently we even talked about the possibility of a minority government, which could then lead to new elections. That's not completely out of the question even now because of this complicated new scenario that the SPD members will have to vote and sort of have a referendum on whatever talks they're going to have. So that's still possible. I think it would, if anything, the one constant is no matter which scenario you look at, Angela Merkel seems certain to stay chancellor. But it's and is now, as of today, seeming slightly more likely that she'll have a very large coalition in parliament with the SPD. But it's still possible that she'll go with the Greens, and it's still possible that we'll have a minority government. And it's also very likely that this will take quite a while longer, until Christmas, maybe even until after Christmas.
So it sounds very much like we're going to be speaking to you many times, even after this. Thank you very much. That was Andreas Kluth, Berlin Bureau Chief for The Economist.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Marcus Hippie. The time is 8:23 in London. It's 9:23 in Belgrade, and that's where we're heading now to check in with our man there, Guy Delaunay. Guy, nice to speak to you this morning. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, pleasure.
Should we start with Belgrade in limbo?
Absolutely. We've got a situation here where the country's largest city, indeed the region's largest city, Belgrade, is in something of a state of flux because the man who runs the city, the mayor, Dragan Djilas, has been removed. He was removed a couple of weeks ago, and we're still no further along, really, to finding out what's going to be happening to the administration of the city. There's a deadline of a couple of weeks' time by which Dragan Djilas has to leave his office, but other than that, we're really still no wiser how Belgrade is going to be run once that deadline is up.
Why was he voted out?
Well, unfortunately for him, he's not just in the wrong party, he's the leader of the wrong party. He's the leader of the Democratic Party, which until last year was the party of government in Serbia. They failed to form a coalition last year, yet Dragan Djilas, because he'd been, I think, largely approved of as mayor by the people of Belgrade, was re-elected in this city, and he maintained power in a coalition. And this is what makes it really rather awkward, with the Socialist Party, who are in government against him these days. And finally, the penny seems to have dropped that this was an untenable position. You can't, at a national level, they said, have the Socialists in government and yet be in Belgrade with the opposition. So ultimately, he had to go.
Guy, I mean, are we talking about Belgrade's own version of the US government shutdown here? I mean, how much of a limbo really is this for Belgrade? What does it mean for logistics, for transport, for things that would have come under the remit of the mayor and presumably now just sort of left hanging?
Yeah, well, transport really is a big issue. You get some people saying a pretext has been used, saying that the lack of progress on building an underground metro was one reason behind Gillis's removal. That really is, I think, just a pretext. But in terms of what we have at the moment in the city in terms of transport, well, there's a dilapidated bus fleet, which was due to get less dilapidated. They'd brought in 200 extra buses. But the problem is there's nobody to sign off on them. The transport chief was sacked last month. The mayor needs to appoint a new one. Whoops, we haven't got a mayor. And there's a real issue there. They can bring in a temporary administration made up of five wise people, but they can only really do what they call emergency measures, keep the city ticking over, clear the streets of snow when that starts maybe next month, but they can't do anything substantive at all. So it really could be quite sticky. It's unknown territory.
Guy, your second story for today is about Kosovo and the upcoming elections.
That's right. These are the interesting local elections which we have in Kosovo on November the 3rd. I know local elections are not really interesting in many countries, but these truly are, because the Serb community in Kosovo, and particularly in North Kosovo, has never recognised the government of the Republic of Kosovo in Pristina. As far as they're concerned, they still live in Serbia. But recently, we've had this normalisation deal between Pristina and Belgrade, and now the politicians in Serbia have been encouraging ethnic Serbs in Kosovo to vote in these local elections. Now, this would, in effect, legitimise the institutions of the Republic of Kosovo in Kosovo, including northern Kosovo. So it's quite a big deal, really, except for some reason, the heads of government in Pristina took it upon themselves to try to ban politicians from Serbia coming into Kosovo to campaign. And this rather soured the good feeling which had been building up in recent months.
Guy, we have to just ask the big question on everyone's lips, though, is has the Kosovan Prime Minister ever sung a karaoke duet with the Prime Minister of Serbia, like you yourself has done?
Indeed. And I asked him just that very question. And this was at a dinner about a week ago where we had a few foreign hacks were sitting down with Prime Minister Ivica Dacic. And he was brandishing a microphone with purpose, shall we say. I had been warned that he was a karaoke fiend. And sure enough, we ended up duetting on a version of Let It Be, a version, I say, advisedly, of Let It Be by the Beatles. The Prime Minister has a pretty good voice, it has to be said. Not quite so sure about your correspondent.
I need to check. Does he do this often with other world politicians?
Do you know, I asked him, because he was grumbling about Hashim Tachi, the Prime Minister of Kosovo, and all the shenanigans over whether they'd be allowed to visit. And I said, well, have you tried just singing with him? And he looked at me as if I'd gone mad. But this was before we had our own sing-song and before quite a lot of rakia was consumed. And at the end of the evening, he gave me a big bear hug and I said, you will promise that you will try to sing. And he said, yes. So we shall see.
I mean, I think we've seen the blueprint for world peace, Guy, right there in this example. I mean, clearly...
Healing
this
the
is
world through music.
Healing the world through music. We all believe it can be done, hope that it can be done, and you've just proved that there's one step towards it. Guy, we won't ask you to sing the Beatles live on air this morning,
well, thank
but
goodness
it's
for that.
Wonderful to have you on the show as ever. Thank you very much for joining us. Guy Delaunay, our man in Belgrade.
London. New York. Tokyo. This is Monaco.
In the next half hour of the programme, we speak with British artist Damien Hirst in Doha. Hear about the children's stories that were told in the early days of the Soviet Union, and we flick through today's European front pages.
First of all, though, we are shortly to hear Paul Osborne with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Ahead of international talks on Iran's nuclear programme, the country's warning it won't hand over any of its enriched uranium. Representatives from Iran are due to meet international negotiators in Geneva this week, but the country's deputy foreign minister has said any request to surrender stockpiles of enriched uranium would cross a red line. A court in Malaysia has ruled non-Muslims cannot use the word Allah to refer to God. It's overturned a ruling by a lower court 4 years ago, saying it would cause confusion among the community. Christians, who say they've used the word in Malay for many years, have argued the ruling is a violation of their religious freedoms. Officials in eastern India say a mass evacuation has saved thousands of lives as a fierce cyclone struck the area. Up to 1 million people fled their homes as the cyclone ruined homes and brought down power lines. Meanwhile, it's now thought at least 109 people died in a stampede at a Hindu festival in central India. Many were on a bridge close to a temple. It's thought the stampede was caused by rumours the bridge was about to collapse. The head of the International Monetary Fund has warned the budget crisis in the United States could tip the world into recession. Christine Lagarde says a US default would cause massive disruption around the world. The government will start to run out of money on Thursday if there's no agreement to raise its debt limits. And the UK is to make it easier for Chinese tourists to enter the country. The visa system is to be simplified, meaning Chinese visitors to the rest of the European Union will no longer need a separate visa to enter the UK. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Paul Osborne. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Marcus Hippie. This week on Culture, Rob Bound heads to Doha to visit some of this season's art openings, and at the top of the list is one of Britain's biggest names.
Damien Hirst has just unveiled the Miraculous Journey 14 huge bronze statues that depict the genesis of human life from nothing to baby, which sit aptly in front of the yet-to-be-completed Sidra Maternity Hospital. At the Al Riwaq exhibition space, he has just opened Relics, a retrospective that displays some of his greatest hits alongside a handful of new works similar to last year's Tate Modern Show.
Well, Rob spoke to Damien Hirst in Doha to talk titles, themes, and whose opinions matter most.
It's like a mathematical sum, isn't it? It's like, you know that 1 + 1 = 2. But I guess when you're making artwork and you're putting things together, you've got an idea that if you put something with something else, it's going to look good with a small g. But it's like when you put it together and it's like looks like 1 + 1 = 3, that's when it's like a great thing, you know. And when things go together and they look like they should have been together forever.
You get that feeling like it's when you hear a great song on the radio and you wonder how it's been done. You must have that. Yeah. You must have had that feeling a lot of times in the studio.
I think anything done well is art, and I think, you know, it's like, I think of that piece by Picasso where he put the bicycle seat with the handlebars to make the bull's head, and you think, oh my God, that moment must have been amazing, because it's like, it just constantly says, what does it mean? You don't know why it's good, but it looks great, and it's. So I suppose you're always looking for things like that. A lot of the time, it looks rubbish. And it goes and you don't show it to anyone.
And I wonder whether you're tempted. You must be keen to know what people think. You obviously know what people think after so long, but whether you ever want to sneak into the private view, or more just on a kind of rainy Tuesday and wander around and hear what people are saying, whether in Doha or in London or wherever. Are you curious to know what people are thinking about?
I think very early on I looked at it, and you think, because I make work that, you know, I'd like people to get passionate about, and I'm very aware that they can be passionately against it as well as passionately for it, so I want to make work that you kind of can't forget, rather than work that you love. I mean, I don't expect everybody to love it. I mean, I think that'd be crazy.
Yeah.
But so very early on, I tried to not enjoy the good reviews so that then I could ignore the bad ones. But it's difficult sometimes. I mean, I put an outdoor sculpture into Devon, where I live. She was a big pregnant lady, and the first day when I went to look at it, there were loads of people around it. They didn't recognise me at all. But as I walked down, there was like a 14-year-old girl stood there, and just as I went past, I just heard her saying, "Oh my God, that's disgusting!" So you think...
That was your fake beard she was talking about, your disguise.
Yeah, no, but you can't please everybody, but I think, you know, I mean, it's healthy debate, I like.
And I wonder whether your themes stay the same. I mean, we've been walked around by Francesco. He's a great talker about your stuff, obviously, and I wonder whether you feel that you can see a progression, or it all just comes from the same place. It just needs to be got out there, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, my concerns have always been the same concerns, really, and it's just different ways of presenting it. I mean, I have a lot of opposing views, and I think in the beginning when I started off being an artist, I thought that was a problem. So I was thinking, like, it makes me think, maybe I don't know what I'm doing, because I do this and I do that. But then as soon as I just accepted that, then I could make all these different types of work. I mean, you know, all my shows sort of feel like a group show with lots of different artists, right, and they all live inside my head. But I think that's...
It's a good form of therapy, right? It's a big space for it.
It's like therapy, yeah. I mean, it's good. But all the art, I mean, you know, you could, every single piece could be a self-portrait or something.
The last thing we saw was 1,000 years and 100 years. And obviously some of the artists that inspired you love that work yourself. Does that make any difference? I mean, aside from caring about what other people think or not caring, the respect to those painters must have been a big deal, right?
I think all the artists that I admire, or, you know, even, you know, people I think who are successful, it's like they've always kind of managed to measure their own success in their own terms rather than other people's. So I think that's something you've really got to work hard at, because an artwork can be successful, but maybe people won't like it, but, you know, it can still be successful in terms of what you're trying to achieve. So I think you've really got to sort of, you know, work out how to measure the right kind of success. So, I mean, throughout my career, I've always managed to do that, you know, and it's like when people, there's been moments when I've been surrounded by people who are telling me I'm brilliant, and I've tried to ignore that, so that you know that when they're all telling that you're less than brilliant, you can just carry on. I mean, Andy Warhol said some great quotes. He said, if everybody tells you that your paintings are no good, make more. And, you know, things like that. And I always, I mean, they're humorous, but I mean, I think they're great techniques. Or he said, don't read your reviews, you weigh them.
There's a skill in the aphorism, right, as well, the epigram. You've got to be...
Yeah, there is. I mean, I remember reading when I was young sort of interviews by artists and thinking, oh, my God, they're so smart. I could never say things like that. And then now sometimes people find a quote by me and lay it out and you go, did I say that? How did I say that? Yeah.
But that was a good party night, probably. That's when the good ones... That's maybe when the good ones come out.
They come out all the time. You definitely get some good ones when you're drunk, but you get some pretty good ones sober as well. And you also can get good ones from people mistranslating what you said.
Your titles, which have always been... We're talking of aphorisms and Warholisms and epigrams and stuff, always so strong. I wonder whether sometimes the titles come before the works.
It comes both ways round. I mean, I hated Untitled, that's for me in the beginning. It's like when I started making art, people were naming titles Untitled, and it so incensed me. I just thought that's so horrible. And especially like Untitled number one, Untitled number two. So I just thought you have to have a title. So then I just tried to think of verbal ways to say what the thing is saying visually. But, you know, sometimes it works very well and other times it doesn't. But then as well, but now I end up with, you know, loads of lists of titles and loads of ideas, and I kind of chopping about with them.
That was Damien Hirst speaking to Monocle's Robert Bound for this week's edition of Culture. And you can catch the full interview in the show, which premieres today or even tomorrow at 7 a.m. in Auckland, tonight at 1900 hours in London and 1400 hours in New York City.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 8:38 and we'll be back right after this with a Russian tale or two.
Do you ever survey a parade of shops and gathered locals and wonder why the scene is so inviting? Well, to find out, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé ventured to Wilton Way, a small thoroughfare in East London's Hackney, to get a read on the ingredients that underpin a community.
In a former post office at number 67, Borough Wines is a perfect example of modern renewal born out of village ideals. The success of Muriel Châtel's Hackney Wine Shop is down to the daily engagement with the locals. In addition to the expertly chosen bottles on the shelves, Borough Wines provides a fill your bottle at the barrel service, offering simply one red, one white, and one rosé at a comforting price.
You can watch Tyler Brulé's Hackney Revival film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has the right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. these things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is 8:40 here in London, 11:40 in Moscow.
All children's literature has one thing in common. It is written by grown-ups, and all the grown-ups have ulterior motives. They have long grasped that shaping the minds of future generations is too important to be left to chance. These are words from the introduction of a book that is a collection of reprints of Russian children's books from the two decades before World War II.
During those years, a group of some of the greatest Russian poets and artists came together to work on picture books for children. They were undoubtedly intrigued by the work, but also motivated by something else. The Soviet Union was a dangerous place for artists, and children's books offered them a place to breathe. Well, I'm delighted to say that we're joined now in the Monocle studio by Olga Budashevskaya, co-editor of Inside the Rainbow, Russian Children's Literature 1920 to 1935, which is subtitled Beautiful Books, Terrible Times. Olga, a very good morning to you, and thank you for joining us. And congratulations on the publication of this absolutely beautiful book. Now, first, I have to ask, your background is as a filmmaker, not as an academic or historian of the Soviet era. Why did you become involved with this project?
Oh, just because Julian Rosenstein is a friend.
And he's your co-editor.
Yes, and I'm probably the only Russian around him. And the books are so wonderful that during our friendship, you know, I was giving him some reprints made in Soviet times recently, and just for him to admire. And at first we decided to do one of Redstone Diaries with those pictures, and so the book naturally grew from that little diary. Everybody was delighted, and we decided to go on with it.
As is mentioned, indeed, in the beginning of this book, all children's literature has one thing in common. It's written by grown-ups, and grown-ups have some motives. Well, when you think of those years in the Soviet Union, and when you lived through these children's books, how explicitly were you able to see the dominating communist agenda and ideology from the pages?
Well, those books were devoted to different subjects. And we tried to reflect it in our book, because we collected it. You know, the first chapter is called Little Comrades, and there was ideology. But when they spoke about, you know, how the world works, or they did some, you know, moral tales, there was much less ideology. And also the important thing here is that the artists and the writers who did those books, they actually belong to the previous era, to pre-revolutionary era. So they tried as much as they could to drag in the old values, the proper values. So when it was an ideological book, then yes, it's vivid. Of course, you can see it. But otherwise, it just belongs to the great world literature.
Olga, we're so used to hearing about how under Stalin, really any creative art, or at least the majority of creative arts, were oppressed. And yet, here we see in this collection a sector of the artistic world that was actually allowed vigorous freedom, really. Philip Pullman, who is, of course, massively successful children's author in his own right, he's written the introduction to your book, and he talks about this vigorous freedom and how important that is. What, in terms of the books themselves, in terms of the art, in terms of the message, what's most extraordinary about them? What's most unexpected and surprising?
Well, the freedom, probably, because the freedom and this romantic idea of creation of something absolutely new, which made them happy at the beginning, because they, although they were people who belonged to the previous world, the artists and writers, they were creating the new literature, and sincerely. And that was the paradox when the party what the party wanted coincided with what people, the artistic, the creators wanted. The children's literature of the 20s actually grew out of the children's books of the world of art movement of the beginning of the century in Russia, which existed in its own right. The artists there created beautiful books for children first time in Russia, and it was a movement that embraced old Russian the history but on the other hand there were futurist books which were incredibly avant-garde and done in unseen before manner, printed almost by hand or heliographically printed. And so these two new traditions coincided in the new books that we are speaking about.
And when you went through those children books, was there something on the pages that you would actually like to see in modern books as well?
Of course. You know, they are funny. They're always funny. It's always humor in the depiction of whatever they do, animals or people. That's what I love about them.
What kind of humor? Can you give us examples?
I don't know. I can't just open the page and it is a tender humor, I would say.
Clearly there's a wit, and certainly graphically there's extraordinary elegance as well, which is ingenuity, which perhaps might be unexpected. Who is the audience of your book for? I mean, are you now intending this for historians of the period or for historians of design or literature or children's literature, or is it designed to be a compendium for anyone who's interested in any of those areas?
Yes, I'd wish to think that it's for everybody who loves, art and talent.
And as we mentioned already earlier, Soviet Union was quite a dangerous place for artists. When you look at the stories of the artists who actually were working with these books, what happened to them in the end?
Well, you know, the two giants of Russian children's literature, Marshak and Chukovsky, they managed to stay not only alive but working. And through the whole century, more or less. Many of them were arrested and shot. And it all started so wonderfully, and everybody was so inspired. But in the end, of course, there was a contradiction between what they were doing and what the party wanted. And by probably 1929, it was obvious that they were going in different directions, and so they were shut down. That's it.
Olga Budashevskaya, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, co-editor of Inside the Rainbow, Russian Children's Literature, 1920 to 1935. Beautiful books, terrible times, and it is indeed a very beautiful book available now.
In a moment, we'll leave through some of the European front pages, but first, to get us in the mood, let's play one of the most iconic songs from the Iberian Peninsula. This is Piensa en mí by Luz Casal.
Piensa en mí cuando sufras. Cuando llores también piensa en mí.
Soothing sounds there. That was Piensa en mí by Luz Casal.
Well, you're listening to Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Marcus Hippie. We're joined in the studio now by Monocle producer Alid John, who's been rifling through the newspapers for us this morning. Alid, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you both. I love the theme music you have to bring me in here.
I love it. It's just very relaxing and kind of, as Marcus said, soothing.
Soothing tones.
Probably you've got less soothing news for us if you're looking through the newspapers.
But potentially there's some good news on the
trade relations, at least, between China and the UK.
Indeed, not just trade, but probably diplomatic as well. Chancellor George Osborne, the Chancellor of the UK, he is in China, along with a bit of an entourage from the UK delegation. So you've got Boris Johnson there, a couple other ministers, and all the diplomats in tow. Chancellor George Osborne is there to drum up trade relations, but also to talk about how relations between the two countries can improve. This is, the context of this is that Britain has kind of, under the radar, been undergoing something of a frosty year with China since David Cameron met the Dalai Lama in London last year. So this meeting, the first of its kind since Cameron, has unofficially been frozen out of relations with Beijing, marks something of a turn.
So what is actually to be expected? How can the situation, the relations, get better?
Well, we look at soft power and trade diplomacy here at Monocle a lot, and China is one of the biggest players in the world. Cameron continually talks about BRICS, the emerging economies, Brazil, India, China. And the fact that we are now being brought back to the table to talk at, I mean, this is a tour of universities to drum up business deals. George Osborne is going to be getting some big contracts in defence, telecommunications, things that won't be headline grabbing. What's headline grabbing is the fact that we are there and we are talking.
You mentioned the diplomatic implications. It's been reported that George Osborne is lifting some of the visa restrictions, which has seen the UK lose something like £1.2 billion a year in lost revenues from Chinese not wanting to have to go through the very arduous visa application process. Now they're going to have a 24-hour super visa, essentially, yeah, which allows Chinese tourists, business people, to enter the country on a Schengen visa, essentially. Yeah, how significant is this?
It's interesting because this, one of the ways that this came to light was that a lot of big retailers were saying we're losing huge revenue here in London and more broadly in the UK. And so, yes, this is a kind of retail-driven thing where they're expecting high-end tourists, supposedly in the realm of spending over £1,500 per trip purely on luxury goods, handbags and whatever it is, perfumes. And so, yeah, the significance of that, the high street should be able to feel a huge benefit from this influx of tourists.
Well, Alid, let's move on from Britain and China to the Spanish press. What's going on over there?
Okay, so what we got in the FT now, this is an interesting report, something of perhaps a bit of a previous report on the construction economy in Ireland. That was one of the biggest factors of Ireland's economy leading up to the 2007 bubble burst, which then, obviously, the story goes on, the banks became insolvent, and Ireland has felt difficulty of seven austerity budgets within the last 6 years.
It's going to hurt.
Yeah, it's painful times. But the next budget is coming out, and Ireland is supposed to be the first nation, that has been receiving bailout packages to withdraw from bailout support from the Eurozone. So the figures that the FT is coming, the report talks about 1.7% growth in construction. Unemployment has fallen from 15.1% last year to 13.3%. This is positive signs in Ireland, where it's hard to really paint a picture from London where construction is actually is doing okay. House prices are rising, but in Ireland, construction, with the lack of construction, the economy has really felt the pain.
An encouraging story from that country. I was trying to ask for a Spanish story, El País. What did you have over there?
Not so much a Spanish story, but more Spanish
European
coverage.
Global, yeah. Story. Spanish, it affects all of us.
Spanish paper, Italian story. Well, actually a Europe-wide story, more likely. This is after the Lampedusa tragedy. 33 people died last Friday. The week before that, over 350 died. That is immigrants coming from Africa and the Middle East trying to escape whatever problems they're facing in their home countries. This is a report from El País. You'll find it in many other papers that Italian administrations are looking to up their presence in the Mediterranean, potentially using drones to offer surveillance of the region and to increase patrols in the hope that this sort of tragedy would not happen again.
Alid, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Monocle's Alid John. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. Thank you very much indeed to our producer, Annabelle Bly, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harriet Thorpe, and our heroic studio manager, Bill Lucy. Up next after the news is The Urbanist. Then stay tuned for The Briefing. Also, Aperitivo, our new show, will air at 1800 hours London time.
And Clemency will be back with Phil Hahn tomorrow at the same time. But now from me, Markus Hippi.
And me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.